Welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, brought to you by Exodus Trail Cameras, the number one podcast for bow hunting product information and hunting stories from across the nation. And now, here's your nine-fingered host, Dan Johnson.
Four-day weekend. Hopefully everybody's having a great Friday. I don't know about you guys, but I have a four-day weekend. Hopefully you guys have a four-day weekend. I am looking forward to it. Going to be doing a lot of family time. Going to be doing a lot of, fishing, hiking, playing outside, getting the kids wet in the river. Just hanging out, being dad, being a husband, putting all the podcast and hunting stuff to the side for about 4 days. Really going to enjoy the time away from work and just have an overall awesome weekend. It's a holiday weekend. It's the 4th of July. We get an opportunity to celebrate this kick-ass country of ours, and we do so with fireworks and family, and those are two cool things, I guess. But today's podcast, man, we're going to be talking with the owner of Heads Up Decoy, and I want to tell you right now, this story is a really cool story. It about a guy who goes with his gut, and he decides he wants to start a product out of passion, his love for hunting, and so the story is really cool, and we BS just a little bit with him about not only the product, but how he got his start, and a little bit about hunting as well. So just an awesome kick-ass podcast as usual, man. And so there's that. But before we get into today's podcast, let's hear from Keith Dvorsnak, the owner and president of Ripcord Arrow Rests, about what the benefits of having a drop-away arrow rest are.
Well, the benefits of a drop-away rest is you have less arrow contact on that rest, which gives you better accuracy, tighter groups, especially at longer distance. It also allows you to get away with a little more hand torque, and guys that punch the trigger or anything, like I said, less arrow contact on that launcher, the more accurate it's going to be.
And there you have it. If you guys want to find out more information about Ripcord, please visit ripcordarrowrest.com and take a look at all the products they offer. If you want to dig a little deeper and put the products in your hand, go find a local dealer. Go to your bow shop. More than likely you have one there. Mess around with it. Put it on your bow and then leave the store with it after you pay for it. And there's that. Now, let's get in to today's podcast with Heads Up Decoy. All right, on the phone with me now from Heads Up Decoy, Garrett Rowe. How you doing today, Garrett?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Dan. It's an honor to be on your podcast. I'm really excited. When you reached out to me, I was tickled.
Well, I tell you what. We've had a guy on before by the name of Travis Glassman. Shout out to Travis. I don't know how many times we discussed it, but any time that I would reach out to him, or we would have some kind of Facebook discussion, he's like, man, you got to get, Garrett on from Heads Up. That product is awesome. I love that product. And, he's produced with it out in, Northwest Kansas. And he lays down some slobs every year. So I'm like, if, Travis says it's good, it's gotta be good. So, here we are.
Right. Yeah. There's proof in the pudding there. He's got a track record of making it work, and
absolutely,
he's good at it. So
him and his wife.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so, no doubt.
So this is, your typical product podcast, but before we get into Heads Up and how that all came about, how was your personal 2016 season?
My personal 2016 season was probably one of my best. I don't I usually go on one trip and out of state, yep. usually elk. And then I, you know, concentrate on, you know, Kansas deer,
right.
and turkeys, you know. So I shot a turkey, which isn't a big deal. I mean, a lot of people shoot turkeys. That's, and then I drew an Arizona elk tag, and this is my second trip down there. First time right. was kind of a nightmare, but, this one was not. I actually, shot an elk, you know, fairly early in the season with my bow. It was, typical, you know, elk hunting fashion. You know, you were roving through, the woods in Arizona, and we were calling, trying to get a response, and one blows up. Like, we were hunting like on the edge of the rim, literally on the edge of the Arizona rim. If anybody is familiar with that, and these elk, I think, were bedded on the ledge of that rim, and this bull elk come right over the top of it, right into our call decoy setup, and I shot him at 30 yards, and he ran down the hill and fell over dead, and I was happy.
Man.
And then for the Kansas deer season, I shot a respectable whitetail buck. He was around 150. I still think 150s are big deer.
Absolutely.
And, I'd seen bigger. I was after bigger, but you know how that is. It never materialized. And I had an opportunity at the buck that I ended up killing, and I took it. So,
right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So
you got to take those opportunities when they present themselves, for sure.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no doubt. And it was a perfect setup for my decoy, and everything happened. Well, let me just tell you, let me rewind a little bit.
Yeah.
So, going back to the elk hunt. You know, just before I shot this bull, he's standing out there 60 yards and rips out a big old bugle.
Right.
Then he walks into bow range and I shoot him. And I was pretty proud of myself on the shot, because I actually used archery as a, you know, the archery science. You know, there was a limb between me and him, and I knew that my arrow was going to fly right over the top of him. And I put my pin right on that limb that was like 20 yards. My arrow just drifted right over the top of it and centered it right in the chest at 30 and ran off. And then for my deer hunt in Kansas, I snuck up onto this buck. He was bedded with a doe, and we'll probably get into this part of it later in the podcast. And he snort wheezed at me at
wow.
25, 30 yards. I couldn't get a shot at him. One of the coolest things that was probably one of the coolest things I've ever witnessed was that buck snort wheezing at me. It was really cool.
Right. I tell you, when some of these animals are vocal, you know, when we think of whitetail, we think of a very quiet animal, but when they're comfortable,
for sure.
and at times aggressive, a whitetail buck being aggressive, a snort wheeze is a very rare thing to hear in the timber, my opinion.
Yes.
Or I guess not necessarily timber where you're hunting at, but what is the terrain where you hunt in Kansas? What's that like?
I would consider it to be broken, and it's a mixture of river bottom, and you can put rivers in quotes. Okay, we call them rivers out here, but they're not like Iowa rivers or Missouri
right.
rivers. Okay, they're creeks, but they're labeled as rivers. And then we'll have pasture ground, which native grass, with pokey things, not
right.
necessarily cactuses, but some cactuses, barrel cactuses, some, oh gosh, what are those paddle cactus thing? I can't remember exactly what they're called. And then like yuccas, and we'll get CRP grass, and then cropland, obviously.
Right. Right.
So that is, and it's not as flat as what I drove to Indianapolis a couple weeks ago, and where I live is not nearly as flat as southern Indiana.
Right.
It's got rolling hills. Our horizon is flat, but we have lots of rolling hills and draws and canyons and things like that. And, And so it's kind of a, it's a mixed bag of everything, really. It's really awesome. I mean, I really love it out here, and you can have whatever kind of a hunt you want. You can kind of have it out here.
Right. Absolutely. Now, where do the, you know, in that area that you hunt, where are the deer typically bedding, and what is their food sources for the most part?
Food sources for the most part would be, corn, dry land corn, Milo. That's usually early dry corn. They'll graze on that stuff all year long. You know, when the corn, you know, gets knocked down and they're still, unharvested cobs laying out there. Milo, they love Milo late summer until it gets cut. And a lot of times they won't leave until the combine almost runs them over out of those Milo fields. So they love Milo.
Yeah.
And then like once that winter wheat really starts to kind of take a stand, they kind of transition out of that and then they go to winter wheat. And there's we have alfalfa bottoms and things like that too. So the alfalfa is good when it's green, but once it, you know, freezes and turns brown, then they abandon that really fast. So,
right.
But that's what they eat. Yeah. So we do have some dry land corn. So, yeah.
So where do they spend, like, where do they spend most of their time bedding at?
Well, I always feel like they spend their time bedding, in thickets and pastures and places where they can get sun and light grass or, you know, edges.
Right.
You know, a lot of it I think has to do with, you know, kind of how the sun hits them. And, but I see river bottom land, unless it's really thick, I see them more just traveling river bottoms, in my opinion, than actually, you know, staying right in that, you know, bottom area.
Right. For sure. Yeah. My uncle, he lives in Southeast Kansas, and it is a lot of pasture ground, not a lot mm-hmm. of ag, and
right.
it's all the only trees are really in the river bottoms, and that's where a majority of the deer are traveling. So,
sure.
Completely different world than what I'm used to. You know, I got like a mixture of big timber and ag field timber or ag field fingers and whatnot. But
right.
But generally, your environment, right? The environment that you hunt in, or you know, anybody in general, if they are going to produce some kind of a product, right? They're going to come up with an idea for a product. Their mm-hmm. environment influences that.
For sure.
Did your environment, transitioning to Heads Up now, did your environment help influence you create Heads Up Decoy?
Later on it did.
Yeah.
So I have been, you know, I was a tree stand hunter my whole life.
Right.
Up until 2008, I think, 2007. And so the idea of, so I kind of, you know, I mean, we've talked we've read and there's just so much information about whitetail hunting out there and how to do it. And most people, I'd say 99% of people hunt from a tree stand. You know, maybe that's a little high, but I mean, it's got to be way up there.
Majority.
So, yeah, the whitetail hunting thing, as it is for me now, was not on the radar. It was not like how I hunt them now. The reason I came up with Heads Up Decoy was because I started elk hunting.
Okay.
And I knew, and what was on the market at the time I started elk hunting was, I knew it would work, but I didn't think it needed to be what it was. A lot of times you're hunting in dark timber. After about 3 days in Colorado Rockies, you're down to a knife, water, and weapon, you know. You know, and fluff things or other accessories, they stay at the camp if you're not seeing elk or hearing elk.
Right. Right.
And so the whole idea was to come up with a partial body decoy that you could you didn't have to stake to the ground or deploy. It was already ready, and you could stick it out and hold it out, provide some movement, because the timber was so thick that, you know, an elk could be in bow range, and even deer, they can be in bow range, and they're still only a portion of their body is exposed to you for you to get a shot or not get a shot.
Right.
And that was kind of the whole philosophy. I just wanted a bull. I wanted a product or a decoy that I could, in the moment, would be ready on demand, something I could run with if I had to, and then something that I could operate,
yeah,
and get the bull's attention. And it didn't, and all it needed to be is just something to validate there's a cow there making those sounds. Now, that was the whole idea. Now, I knew that I needed more. And most of the time when people think about big game decoys, at the time, maybe for me, I thought antelope. Oh, everybody antelopes or hunts antelope with a decoy, which isn't really true either. But there is a decoying part of antelope hunting. And so I threw the antelope decoy in there, and then it took a while for me to get the design down,
right,
and how to structure the decoy to make it functional and hold up through the rigors of a hunt, or multiple hunts, for sure, multiple mm-hmm. hunts. And then once I kind of got that elk decoy down and the antelope, the antelope and the mule deer doe were really easy to come up with. And I knew that the mule deer doe out where I live would be ridiculous, and it has been ridiculous. I don't hear every story because people are pretty protective of what they shoot or the stories that they tell or where they hunt. It's just the reality out here sometimes.
Right.
And but I've run into some people at different shows or different events, or whatever, a 3D or something, and I've seen them lip my name. You know, I've read their lips reading my name, and they would come up to me, and I'm thinking about one older gentleman come up to me and literally had a photo album of the mule deer that they killed with my decoy.
Yeah.
Never heard a peep out of him. Not
yeah.
one single word. You know, yeah, he was at full draw. He thought this big one was behind this barn, he was at full draw waiting for it to step out, and the little one come up and bump the decoy while he was at full draw. Like, I never hear stuff like that, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, and so the mule deer doe was the third decoy I came up with, and it's produced and created a lot of great opportunities for and great stories for people, and it's kind of changed the game for, you know, mule deer hunters out here. Then I came up with the whitetail doe because, you know, the whitetail market's the largest.
Yep.
And so the doe was, and I didn't come up with a buck until, because I couldn't figure out how to make antlers. You know, it took me a long time to figure out how to make an antler for this and then not have it be part of the decoy. And one day I was just hunkered down in a Milo field one morning hunting, and I figured out how to do it. And so in 2010, I came up with my whitetail buck decoy, and that changed my life for bow hunting.
Okay.
It changed my bow hunting life right there at that moment. The turkey was back in 2009, 2010 as well. But the whitetail buck, you know, they've all changed my life for the better or for the worse. Obviously, heads up decoy is a huge part of my life now, and it's constantly on my mind, but the whitetail buck has changed the way that I bow hunt probably as long as I'm physically able.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
So I want to go back just a second though and talk about that initial, you know, there's a moment where you decide to follow through on an idea. And you mentioned that you were up in the, you know, you're up elk hunting. Did you fail several times or get busted several times or couldn't get the bull in close enough several times that made you say, man, I need a decoy with me, and I need it to be I need it to be smaller than the other decoys on the market.
Well, I don't know. Failure, you could classify the failure component, and we were miserably we failed miserably getting into elk.
Yeah.
Okay. Period. I still do. It's hard. I mean, you know, Colorado over-the-counter units are hard to hunt, and some people are really good at it. We are getting better at it. You know, we've had some success, lots of failure. That's just kind of how it is. But there was two moments in my life where I thought about heads up decoy. One was a public land whitetail hunt in Kansas when I was packed in about a mile from the road from my vehicle, in a, just one solitary tree. And I was watching all these deer moving out in the pasture, and I knew that I couldn't carry a loud 3D decoy to that tree stand. I didn't want to. I could, but I didn't want to.
Right.
And I was like, you know, I could put a decoy on a stick, just a head, like a lollipop, and just stick it in the ground high enough to peek over the grass and simulate a bedded doe. And maybe clip it to a tree or something like that. And then I left it at that, 1999. I was 1999. Yeah. And then when I started elk hunting, you know, and I don't mean this in a bad way at all. You know, the Primos Truth videos are awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, those elk videos are freaking awesome. But that is, it's hard to find that type of an elk hunt. And yeah.
Well, they're, so when I'm pretty sure they're using outfitters, you know.
Low pressure.
Yeah. And that's what you see on a lot of the TV shows.
Yeah.
We talk about that all the time on this podcast, you know, is low pressure, highly managed ground versus probably what you're going and you know, being frustrated because the elk are really high and really far from the roads.
Yes, you may get one day where it's, you know, falls out, everything. Yeah. I mean, every tree is bugling or whatever. You may get one day, maybe two, if you're lucky three, and that's it. And that's if you're really covering a lot of ground. And so we were looking at what do we need? What potentially could help us? And then, you know, the decoy thing kind of came up. And when I went up there, I'm like, okay, there's no meadows up here. There's no places I can see a long ways. I'm seeing 60, 70, 80 yards max. You know, my brother's standing 20 yards from me. And if he's standing there, I can't see him. You know, it's, you can lose your partner really fast. And I'm like, you don't need that. All you need is just something small that you can carry every day, either whether you're hunting from the truck or you're backpacking, you know, 6 miles back into the wilderness. And so I was telling my boss this at the time, and he had, and I don't know, just very coincidental, I guess. I guess that I was telling him about this. I said, I think you just need like a head, just a, you know, of an elk decoy, and I think it would work. And he goes, well, the guy that's roofing my house has an elk farm 20 miles north of here, Garrett. It's like, you're shitting me. And I said, no. And he goes, no. And so I called him. He said, yeah, no problem. Come up, take as many pictures as you want. And so that was when the whole process started. And that's kind of how, now it's 2006, 2007, me and the turd in my pocket started developing this product now known as Heads Up Decoy.
Okay. So you went to an elk farm, you took some pictures of some elk. Did you have any past experience, or what were you doing before Heads Up Decoy? I mean, was it kind of a similar from a material standpoint? No. So it was a completely new idea for you, a completely different path in the road.
Yes, for sure. I'm a hunter first. I'm a bow hunter first, and I have Heads Up Decoy also. I mean, I enjoy shooting animals with my bow. And so, yes, Heads Up Decoy is, that's I started that all from ground zero, from conception, basically. I had no experience. I mean, I literally spent hours and hours and hours finding different suppliers. I've gone through, I don't even know how many different suppliers over the course of since I've started Heads Up Decoy, and to get it to the point that it is now, and it still has a long way to go. I mean, it's still, you know, we still, in my opinion, aren't selling as many as we should, because they are effective and they do work. But, I started all this with I had no experience in anything other than healthcare. And luckily, Dan, there are beautiful people in this world that are willing to help you.
Yeah.
And so I walked into this place. I mean, and I don't want to encourage people. I'm not saying this to encourage people to get into the outdoor industry, because it's tough. It's not, in my opinion, what it appears to be on social media. It's hard. And it's watered down, and there's a, you know, it's tough. But at the time, it wasn't like it was now. Facebook was just kind of beginning to, you know, kind of kick in. But I walked into this. I kept making phone calls, because I knew if I kept making phone calls, Dan, that eventually somebody would know something.
Yeah.
And that is, and that's essentially what happened. We had some people here in town that, you know, made athletic apparel, braces and things like that, and well known. And I didn't even think about them. And I walked in, and I had this guy looked at my just absolutely ridiculous prototype that was so sad and so pathetic. And he looked at me in the eye, and he took me serious.
Yeah.
And so then, so I always blame him for everything now. I said, you know, if it wasn't for you, and he's an older fellow. He's, I think, in his mid-60s or something like that. Just awesome guy, and always picks up the phone and always helpful. And he's been around the world a million times with, you know, and he understands, you know, suppliers, and he's touched a lot of people all over the world, you know, or been in contact with a lot of people. He knows how to communicate. Just, you know, he's a guy that, you know, he's been so helpful. And so that's kind of how it all started, really. I mean, I learned a lot from him, and then, you know, the School of Hard Knocks just teaches you a lot too.
Right. Right. So this, what was this first prototype made out of? You know, you went into this guy, I mean, was it like a cardboard cutout with a picture painted on it, or what was it?
Pretty close.
Yeah.
It was a bed sheet.
Okay.
With a Sharpie, a blue Sharpie marker, traced around this pathetic plastic frame that I designed that had way too many parts in it, and I showed him, and I asked him if he could sew around it, and he goes, "Yeah, we could sew." I go, "I don't have a picture on this. You're just gonna have to imagine it, an elk." He goes, "Yeah, we could probably sew something around." And then he kind of was fiddling around and telling me about some of the plastic stuff, because I was just kind of telling him some of the things that I was having problems with at the moment. He goes, "You know what? If you come in with some stuff, you know, we'll sew it for you." Because at the time, my mom was sewing some of my prototypes.
Okay.
And then I think it was like 6 months later, I walk in with a totally different prototype. In fact, the one that I have right now, as far as like the elk image. And he was like, "Holy shit, you know,
yeah,
this is a huge improvement. Yeah, we'll make these for you." and he's an outdoor guy. He likes to fish and hunt, and he's intrigued with that, you know? And so that was an easy sell for me. And so at that point, then it's just kind of been, it's, you know, the rest is history. So
was this something that, you know, typically before a business is even make it to be considered a business, they go through some kind of research and development stage to justify that the amount of time, energy, and money that they're about to start putting into a company is going to pay off in the long run. Did that ever cross your mind, or did you believe so strongly in this these prototypes that you just knew that by grinding you were going to it was going to take off?
I knew that somebody was going to do it if I didn't.
Yeah.
Because I felt that strongly about the concept. And people still, I mean, I'll go to trade shows and stuff, and people still go, so those things really work? And I just want to say so bad, nah, I just, you know, put this ginormous burden on my family and my life just so I could pull a practical joke on them. Yes, they work. I would not be here if they did not work, and they work. And so, and I have under, when I first developed them, Dan, I didn't know how good they did work. We learned a lot of shit, man.
Yeah. That's awesome.
The only reason why I'm saying that word is because I've heard you guys say it on this podcast before.
Well, I tell you what, if that's the only word you've heard, then you need to listen to more podcasts.
I've heard a couple other ones too, but that one. So that's really, I all that stuff was like, okay, I got to get it out here. Let's just learn as we go.
Right.
It was essentially, Dan, is kind of how I, and I'm not recommending that to anybody.
Right, right. So my question is, and I keep going back to these prototypes, but were you out in the field hunting with a silhouette, or you know, with a bed sheet on it?
No, but I think you could kill one with a bed sheet.
Okay,
just a brown one, but don't tell anybody that.
Yeah. What kind of testing did you do in the field before you said, you know what, I'm going all in with it.
The only test was, is it gonna, can it make it into the wilderness and back without breaking? That was the test.
All right.
That was it.
So how did you test that? Just go on hikes and mess around with it?
No, I took it on elk hunts and we used it and it held up. And so at that point, it was just a matter of getting people to believe in the concept. And most bow hunters, I think most bow hunters, and I'm not saying all, but I think the majority of bow hunters will, let me just say this, every bow hunter has been in a situation where they've seen a deer or an elk or whatever cross in front of them and they hadn't seen the whole animal.
Yeah.
And that was our entire concept. So when I was building these, and it's kind of refreshing because I forget all this stuff. I forgot all of this because it's been a while. I mean, and so when I was developing this, I didn't want a blob. I didn't want to make a decoy that looked like a blob. I wanted it to have some shape and some defining features that gave it some realism. Even, you know, as much as a partial body decoy could possibly have, I wanted it to have those features. I wanted there to be some shape to it. So when it was presented to an animal that you're trying to decoy, when they saw it, they recognized the shape of it. They, you know, and it wasn't just some type of a blob. I think the shape is very important. And that's really kind of how I started all this. And I think our mule deer doe, or a whitetail buck, I mean, they kind of, and the elk, and they kind of epitomize that philosophy. They have shape and contour and defining features that when seen from a distance, whether it be 500 yards or 60 yards, that they can say, hey, that's one of me.
Right. Right. All right. So you came up with this idea, right? You finally talked someone into making it for you. You know, you don't necessarily...
I talked somebody into sewing it for me.
right. Sewing it for you.
Yeah.
So you have a product now, but you don't have any clientele, which is kind of important when you're starting a business.
It is important.
What did, how long did it take for you to get people to get one of these in their hands? And then what was the initial reaction? Was it, yeah, I guess this works. Or was it just like a, oh my God, I'm never hunting without one of these again?
That took a while to get to that point.
Yeah.
So in 2009, I went to the ATA show. People, they looked at it. I sold a handful of them online, made a couple other connections and proposals with some other influencers out there, developed a pro staff. And I don't want all your listeners to hang up now, you know, or turn you off. You know, you have to have some people out there using your stuff.
Yeah.
And some of the there are bona fide pro staffers out there, but there's also legitimate guys. And I'd like to think that all the guys that are, I would consider to be pro staff, they use it because they know the decoy can help them.
Right.
And they're not going to lie to you.
Right.
And so once we developed that, and then we started getting some video, and in 2009, I walked up onto a mule deer buck in Cut Milo Field after 4 hours of trying to get this thing to come to me. His doe kept cutting him off, literally. Like, no, you're not going to see her. You're not. Okay. And then he'd start kind of moseying on, and she'd get up. She'd go, no, I told you, you're not going to see her. And and so we started getting a little bit of rain. It was getting cold. And a buddy that was filming says, why don't you just walk up on her, see if you can just shoot him. It's cold and I'm hungry. You know, it was literally at that. I mean, we've been out there for 4 hours. And I said, okay. So they kind of stood up and they started feeding. And then I stepped over the Milo field with the decoy. And at that time, I had developed the decoy, the bow mount, and the clamp, which is part of the things that help the decoy operate. And I had to have
going
the decoy in my bow mount. And so this mule deer buck and doe were just kind of feeding. And I just would, when they'd put their heads down, I would step over the top of the Milo stalks and close the distance. And they'd go back to doing what they'd look up at me. And then when they were kind of coming up, I'd kind of squat down. And eventually I got to 30 yards of this buck. I probably could have got closer, Dan, but that's the first time I think anybody's ever done something like that. Certainly for me, I felt weird. It was a very bizarre feeling because there was nothing between me and that buck besides that decoy and air. And, you know, the Milo stalks were at my knees. And so I thought, hey, he's relaxed. I'm at 30 yards. I could make this shot. And then I shot him.
Yeah.
And we caught all that stuff on film. Now, keep in mind that deer, that buck, and that doe had seen that decoy for several hours. So they had already accepted me as one of them. So I probably could have gotten closer. I didn't know that at the time, but now I kind of know that. I understand that, you know, they've already determined that no matter how funky I do kind of look, a long time ago, I convinced them that I was a mule deer doe.
Yeah.
So that was in their mind. And then, so that was 2009. So, and we got that on video. It's on my YouTube channel. And so that was kind of a revolutionary type of, deal there. And then we took the show to the Denver ISE show and we had some footage. I mean, we had deer footage and we had some other stuff, antelope footage, and people would stop and they'd see the footage and then we'd explain the philosophy and the concept and the elk hunters were like, hell yeah, I get this. I needed that last year. And so then that's kind of when it started kicking off was January of 2010. And then later on that year, Dan, is when I got the whitetail buck. And then we kind of had another moment there of redefining archery hunting as I know it. When I shot this enormous 7-point gnarly buck in a Milo field, my buddy was holding the buck decoy. We got to 60 yards, 70. He grunted at him. he stood up, looked at us, totally pissed. And he postured in from 70 yards, and I shot him coming into us at 17-ish.
Jesus. And so what's that? That's got to be a rush. I mean, something.
It was
something
freaking. If you watch the video on my YouTube channel, you will feel the emotion. Because I get so much crap from a buddy of mine because is that the toasted? I mean, we call him the toasted buck because I said I toasted him like 17 times. I don't know how many times, but it was a lot.
Yeah.
And since then, we discovered a new way to kill whitetails.
Yeah.
And I've had since then in open country, or even you know some of the river bottoms, depending on wind. You know, I've decoyed in many whitetail bucks, little guys, spikes, posturing in half racks, to some you know some really big ones, and. You know, and obviously, you know, the whitetail buck or decoying one to finish, and when I say finish, commit to you is the way to do it. But, you know, there's a lot of different ways to use the product. It is bow mountable. You can clamp them to a tree. The clamp and the bow mount are universal for every decoy, the turkey. And I've shot at everything and killed almost everything with one of the decoys in the bow mount.
Yeah.
But it's originally a handheld decoy because, Dan, if you come out here, you're going to have to deal with the wind and I don't get to pick the best days to go hunting. I'm still right. Basically a weekend hunter. Mother Nature can kick your butt out here with the wind. And if it's November 5th and it's blowing 25 miles an hour or 30, it's November 5th.
Right.
And you got to go and hunt.
Yeah.
And so it's not fun sitting in a tree stand when the wind's blowing like that. Deer movement is maybe a little tougher. And so going after them, looking, being, you know, searching for an animal in open country, which oftentimes they are. And then having somebody you trust, a buddy, to go along with you. To hold the decoy up in that wind is important, and it's yeah. been it's we've reproduced that setup many times.
Yeah. So this there's not only a bow mount for it, but there's also like a stick that sticks into the ground that you can kind of get. How does that work?
Well, okay, so I make a ground stake for the turkey, but I don't make a stick that sticks in the ground for the big game decoys. Okay. I make a clamp. So you find like a bush or something or a branch, and you slide the handle into this clamp, and then you clamp the decoy to a solid object. And the clamp is like a heavy-duty clamp, again, because we deal with a lot of wind, so it can tolerate some and withstand some wind. Now, obviously, if it's 30 miles an hour, 40, which it can be, you've got to find some protection, or because it won't hold up. It's a silhouette decoy, you know. But if you get into some protection, it'll still. It's designed to hold up into some wind and hold the decoy stationary and appropriately. So,
right. So. I mean, obviously you're the owner. You have great confidence in this product. Talk to me specifically, more in detail, about how you use some of the, you know, how you use the product. And because most of my listeners are probably whitetail hunters, and they're from more than likely they're all from the East Coast. Talk to me how someone from let's say Iowa, Missouri, all the way east and south could use a heads-up decoy.
Well, it would be somewhat different than what I would consider to be ideal, but not out of ordinary. Right. So I think about everybody has some type of grassland, some type of ag ground, some type of fingers or tree rows or things that maybe, or property that they would consider unhuntable because of a stand location. You can't put a stand in there. I see them out there running all over the place, but I can't put a stand up there. There's no place to put a stand. This is where my decoy equalizes that and neutralizes it and gives you an upper hand purely during the rut. And I don't like to upsell people. I consider my whitetail buck decoy to be the one to get for the rut, but because I have so much confidence in it. So you can still do the traditional tree stand hunting. Okay. You get in there before, you know, first light, maybe you hunt till 10 or 11. And you can go to little pockets. If you have pockets on your property where you think there may be a buck and a doe bedded during the day. So the way I see animals work are bucks. Whitetail bucks, they like to push a hot doe away or one that's close to estrus and isolate them from competition.
Right.
And they'll figure out where those places are and they'll push them up there. And a lot of times it seems like a great, you know, where you're, you know, if you think about quail hunting, if you quail hunt and you're hunting all these little, you know, grass ditches or, and thickets and stuff, that's where they are, in my opinion. Yeah. And if you get the wind in your favor and you can sneak in, you can clamp the decoy to maybe a limb 50, 60 yards away, or have a buddy hold it or whatever. And you can do a grunting and a rattling sequence, in the middle of the day. And sometimes you'll, you know, if you keep doing that enough, eventually you're going to pull one out of there. You know, you're going to hit the right spot. And a friend of mine does that to perfection. He will say, well, I didn't see anything today, so I'm just going to go. And it's still around here, but he finds these little hidey holes and he cold calls, you know, and he'll pull in these bucks out of these draws and ditches, several times. And so it's an all day affair for him so he'll use rattling and grunting sequences. And when I rattle and when he rattles, we hit the antlers together as hard as we possibly can. I mean, I can smell the friction of the sparks from the antlers. I use the biggest antlers I can get. So the sound carries as far as it can. And then I make it so the decoy is visible. So if they stand up or if they are coming from 60, 70 yards, they see the antlers. And at that point, the only thing that's going to stop them is the arrow.
Right. Right.
And so that's how I would tell somebody from east of Salina, Kansas, maybe, or east of Topeka to hunt them. But there's still plenty of places out there that have a lot of pasture ground and a lot of places. I mean, if you can see deer in a pasture field or in ag ground, and there's some type of topography, you got a chance.
Yeah.
You have a chance.
So, you know, you probably messed up a lot when you first started hunting with that. That's just me. My guess is that when you started using these heads up decoys, in your hunting regimen, I take it there was some trial and error you had to go through. What was the error? What were some of the mistakes that you made, when hunting with a decoy that screwed you the most that my listeners out there could benefit from?
Well, I would say, whether you're using a 3D decoy or a heads-up decoy or anything else, a decoy cannot take an animal by surprise.
Yeah.
It's got to be seen. And so hiding it, getting in too close, taking them by surprise, that is probably the thing that I learned the most. You know, there's nothing we don't really try you know, sometimes they just don't want to have anything to do with it. It's reality. It's a decoy. They don't want to have anything to do with it. I don't know how many times I've left the truck saying, we're either going to scare him or kill him. And so, you know, it's so much, every situation is so different, but I would say by and large, the thing that we learn the most is do not get too close to them. And then all of a sudden you pop up a decoy and they just freak out. There's this little buffer, a 60-yard buffer, 80. Sometimes it's farther than that, Dan. I mean, sometimes it's 300 yards.
Yeah.
But every animal does not like to be taken by surprise, because most of the time they feel like they should have recognized that an animal like a deer that size they'd see him or something. And so that is probably the biggest. And then, you know, I'd say one of the most frustrating aspects of trying to get a whitetail buck is when you have a satellite buck there. So you've got a dominant buck, a doe either that's in estrus or getting close, nearing estrus, and you've got a couple of pesky guys harassing them, darting in and out. The buck, that dominant buck is not going to leave her. And you got to work really hard to kind of get into bow range with the decoy. But usually when it's just a buck and a doe, then you're almost, the percentages are so good if you can get to 60 yards or 100 or 80 or whatever, that he's going to come in, he's going to feel threatened, and he's going to try to escort you out of there. So the trial and errors are mostly just, try not to scare them by getting too close. And every animal kind of has its own tolerance. At some point, it's just not going to – it's either going to say, okay, I've had enough of you, I'm coming to kick your ass, or I'm coming to check you out, sometime like in a mule deer situation. Okay, I'm going to come over, I'm going to check you out.
Yeah.
And – or they're just going to say, you know what, something just doesn't feel right, I'm shagging ass out of here, see you later.
Right.
And that's – so we try to push the envelope to get that animal to do something. Sometimes it's what we want, and other times it's not. And having this screw it, it just might work mentality, we've done a lot of crazy stuff and had some really cool interactions with animals in open country and death – I mean, just – so close, and 10 yards, it's just kind of neat. I don't know how to explain it. I wish everybody could have that sensation, but over the years, I suppose we just, it's a rutting, it's the whitetail buck is certainly a decoy you want to use in the rut,
right? So of all the, let me start over with that question. You make a turkey,
yep.
A tom turkey. You make a antelope buck, right?
Uh-huh, yes.
You make a mule deer doe.
Yep.
And then a whitetail doe and buck, right? That's what
and you, a mule deer what, buck.
And a mule deer buck.
And okay. A moose.
And a moose now. Okay.
Yeah.
A moose cow?
It could be.
Yeah.
Because the antlers come off. The horn.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, the horn on the all my buck, my male decoys, the antlers pop off, so you can stuff them inside and so you could have a one antlered. I mean, if you think my, I don't want to sound like I know what I'm doing, but when it came to the whitetail buck decoy, we kind of had an idea thinking how it would work. And how we wanted to design it, me and the Turd in My Pocket, and some other people that helped, that kind of had some input. We wanted to make it big because we wanted it to actually threaten a mature buck. We wanted to be a threat. We didn't want to be, a little turd.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of, we were right with that. And in fact, you can decoy any animal, any buck with that big whitetail buck. I've proved it 100 times. Later on in the year, though, they do get a 2.5-year-old buck is going to start getting a little gun shy because they've kind of had their butt whipped enough times that now they kind of figured out that, you know, probably not be so tough.
Right. Right.
So.
So of all the products that you make, what product seems to work the best as far as decoying in or you getting closer? Is it the whitetail? Is it the antelope? Is it the turkey? Where have you seen the greatest amount of success?
Well, probably turkeys because they're so prolific.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're not trophy hunting turkeys. If it's, especially when you're bow hunting, you know, I shot at Jake this year and I was pretty damn happy, you know?
Yeah.
And you get to use the decoy a lot during the season. So yeah. Turkeys is probably, I've killed more turkeys because you can shoot two of them. And I could go to Nebraska or South Dakota and shoot a pile of them up there if I wanted to. But you can shoot a lot of turkeys. You got friends that enjoy that. And so we shoot a lot of turkeys with the turkey decoy.
Right.
Mostly with a decoy in the bow, or when it's really windy, we'll have somebody holding the decoy and then we'll be in their hip pocket. I would say my mule deer doe and my whitetail buck would be the next two. And then I'd say my elk is the next. And not a distant, I sell more elk than I do anything else. Because of it, they weigh less than a pound, and they do pack, and they are easy to use, and they're ready on demand. I think people understand that now, and they get it. So because of that factor, I sell a lot of those, more of those than anything. But I would say that an elk reaction is probably not as slam dunk as a whitetail buck.
Right. Right.
And I'm not as proficient at elk hunting. I've had a lot of good reactions with elk when they have seen it, me personally. But you know, like if I lived in Colorado, I'm sure I would say my cow elk is the best. My whitetail, I don't know.
Right.
You know,
right.
I wouldn't know what I know about my whitetail if I lived in Colorado.
Right. Right. So how you said some of these decoys, you know, they're fairly lightweight. I guess we never really got into the specifics of them. What do they weigh? What are they made out of? And how small do they pack down into?
They pack down fairly small, a little bit bigger than a dinner plate. Now, keep in mind, my priority of making the decoy was not how well it packed down. It needed to be somewhat packable, but not how well it packed down. My priority was when it was assembled, did it have shape and contour? Was it representative of the silhouette of the animal that we were trying to decoy? So they weigh less than a pound. Even the buck decoys, I think they're closer to a pound. They have a cloth, double printed mirror image. Print of an animal, doe, whatever. And then inside the decoy is a semi-rigid, flexible plastic tubing that's impervious to the elements, freezing temperatures, heat. Well, some heat, like antelope-type heat, it can bend. I've never, technically, I don't know if I've ever had anybody say that the tubing bent, but you know, obviously the plastic tubing, when it gets 80 degrees or 85 or 90, is not going to be as rigid as it is when it's 20 degrees. But they do, we have a handle that once the decoy is assembled, and I'm looking at my decoys right now and every one of them is assembled. I seldom do I take them apart. Most of the time I just strap them to my back, Dan, and but there's a handle that slides into the bottom of the frame and goes into the decoy and connects to a fitting, and you push this fitting in and there's like a little groove in the fitting and or in the handle, and there's a fitting that has a notch, and then it that keeps the decoy from spinning in the wind. And then the same notch is on the bottom of the handle. So when you want to put in your bow mount or your clamp, it won't spin in the wind.
If it's windy, you don't necessarily want to attach it to your bow though, for fear of losing accuracy.
For sure.
But there is options. You can have another buddy, hold it, or you can clamp it into a bush or something like that, right?
That is true.
Okay.
Yes. I've okay. shot some animals and killed them deader than a doornail in probably some wind. I probably shouldn't have done it, but I did it because I just felt like I could. And
right. Right. Okay.
I had the confidence that I could do it. And, but generally once that wind gets to be 15 or so, you're probably at the max of what the decoy holds up. It's just, you know, it's going to put a lot of burden on your bow.
Right. Absolutely. All right. So we've discussed heads up, we've discussed, how they're, what they're made out of, how, and how much they weigh, the fact, kind of a little bit of the history of the company, but let's talk about results. I want you to share with us a story of maybe not necessarily ending in a kill, but ending in a, like, where your heads up decoy performed absolutely flawlessly and you had an animal very close or, respond very well to that decoy.
I've had a lot because early on when I saw how well the whitetail buck decoy, and I'll just use it as a, I'm not going to talk about the whitetail. I'm going to talk about the most tragic hunt I've ever been on.
Okay.
To this day, it still haunts me. We were traipsing around Colorado, drawing blanks on a lot of different places. My brother and I, we did our best to get in the best shape we could. We geared up for all these, spike camping, backcountry hunting type things. Went into a spot only to find an outfitter had, kind of set up city, and we were coming out as he was going in to take his clients. He knew that we weren't going in there because he was there. And so we were back in the truck kind of upset that, okay, where do we go now? Not at him, but where do we go now? He got on his horse. He dumped those guys off. Got on his horse, and we saw him coming across this huge open meadow, two Pabst PBRs in his satchel, gave it to us. Hey, man, I didn't want to chase you guys out. And I told him, I said, I'm thinking about going here. What's this place like? And he said, there's elk in there. I said, thank you. So we drank our beer, got our packs on, went into this place, got in there late, set up camp. Waited till first light because we had no idea where we were at.
Yeah.
And I was looking at my little topo map and I told my brother Jeff, I said, okay, we're going to walk up this trail about a mile. And then there's this ridge. Let's get on that ridge. Let's get off the trail about 300 or 400 yards and I'll bugle and see what happens. He goes, sounds like a good idea. So we got up onto that ridge, a lot of deadfalls. People haven't been in Colorado recently. It's tragic. There's beetle kill. So there's a lot of deadfall now.
Yeah,
dead pines everywhere. Oh boy. And it's hard to hunt. It is. It's hard. You can't get anywhere fast. And, you move right to get a shot to your left and now you've lost your shot to the right. It's just like that. And so I rip off a bugle and boom, one hits me right back. He was close. And I had my bow strapped to my backpack, because it was my brother's day. I said, Jeff, this is your day. I'm going to call for you all day long. I don't care if we get into 50 bulls. This is your day. And so I called. He answered me right away. My brother drops to his knees because he was close. And I said, Jeff, I see legs. in through the sun, through the, you know, the sun had kind of peeked over the top of the mountain and was shining on that hillside. I could see the legs of that bull. He starts coming down and he bugled at us. I could see him, and I rip off another bugle, challenge bugle, and I could see his head. And my brother is right down, you know, 3 yards from me, in front of me, and I could see that this bull was looking for us. I could see his head moving back and forth. And I had the decoy out, and I knew he couldn't see it. And I kept moving it. I literally, Dan, had this decoy above my head, sticking it way out. And this bull shook his head a couple times, saw the decoy. He was at 7 yards in a matter of 3 seconds.
Wow.
My brother is at full draw. And in the back of my head, I got an email from a guy that has been using my decoy in a different setting than what we do. And he said his partner, once that bull gets into shooting lane, his partner moves that decoy, stops that bull dead for me so I can shoot him. I thought that bull was in his shooting lane. I thought it had cleared enough stuff. And so I moved that decoy into my other hand, and he stops on a dime. And that bull is 7 yards away from us. My brother is down below me. I'm looking at this bull. I see my brother at full draw, not shooting. And I was like, shit, Jeff, shoot. Get him. Shoot him. You know, yeah. Quartering two, you know, frontal, whatever. You know, he's right there. You can make that the shot he could have made. I mean, and the bull turned and shagged out of there, and it was over. And he had like a 300-inch type frame on one side and like a 4-foot-long straight pole off the other. We got a good look at this bull, and he said I couldn't shoot because right in front of that front shoulder there was this one sapling going right through his vitals.
That sucks.
And I when I tell people about hunting elk, I tell them, I said, you got to use it, because when they're looking for something, they got to see something. If you don't show it to them right away when they're looking and they have an opportunity to kind of assess the situation, and then all of a sudden you pop it out,
yeah,
that you're not going to get a very good reaction.
Yeah.
And I could read that bull, and that's what happened.
And so, just by chance, that sapling was right in the way of his vitals.
Yes.
Man, that's a heartbreaker. But it proves that, you know, everybody can use that that decoy just a little bit different, for different
sure.
results.
Yeah, there is no one way to use my product. It's really develop your own proficiency, and that's kind of the beauty about it. There's a lot, and that includes taking it and not using it. You know, I mean, there's times when you don't need a decoy, and
yeah.
You know, but there are times when I think our decoy can do a lot of different things at different times. It does. It's not just something to attract an animal. It can help you get from point A to point B, or it can distract, you know, from your buddy who's kind of trying to crawl around the other side of this thing, or, you know, just, there's just so many different possibilities right. with the decoy. And there's, you know, you can put it in your bow. You can clamp it to a tree. You can handheld hold it. You can hunt from a tree stand. You can rove. You can do whatever with this. That's kind of the,
right.
There's just no one way to use it. And we've used it a lot of ways.
Right. So, you know, we've talked about the product now and whatnot, and, you know, maybe a guy or gal is considering, you know, no matter where they hunt or if they're going on a Western trip for either mule deer or elk or whatever, why should they consider picking up a heads-up decoy for this upcoming season?
Well, because there's no one, like I said earlier, there's no one way to use it. It's a versatile product. It's not designed to use one way, but it's also designed to create opportunity when opportunity is not likely. I mean, very, very few times are you going to crawl in through a Milo field or corn stalks and get a shot opportunity at a whitetail. Well, this could change everything for you. It could, you know, if you could get 60, 80 yards away from a buck that's rutting with a whitetail doe and show him that decoy, he may be 10 yards in front of you closing. And the only thing that stops him is an arrow. I mean, that's what can happen.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, man, I really appreciate you taking time to come on the podcast, talk about Heads Up, talk about the success, and good luck this upcoming season, not only from the business standpoint, but in the field as well.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. It was it's an honor to be on your podcast. I enjoy the ones that I've listened to, and I hope people enjoyed this one.
Huge shout out to Garrett for coming on the podcast and talking about Heads Up. If you're still listening, and hopefully you are, Heads Up has decided to take part in a giveaway this week. And you will be, if you win, you will be given one Heads Up decoy of your choice. And here's how you win. First thing you got to do is go to the Nine Finger Chronicles Facebook page and share the post that mentions this podcast. You got to click the share button and share it on your personal page. Then you need to go to Heads Up Decoy, like that page, and comment Nine Fingers sent me. And by doing those things, it's pretty easy. You will be entered in to win the giveaway. Also, be sure to pay attention after the 4th of July for the very first Lone Wolf giveaway results. I will be digging through and kind of organizing it to where I can get a name out of the hat at random. I'll be drawing it, and then I will be making an announcement next week sometime for a set of four sticks. That's the first product that is going to be given away. And then the next products are going to be the Alpha, the Climber, and the Assault. And I think in that order, I'm not 100% sure, but August 1st, September 1st, and October 1st for those. Other than that, guys, follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Be sure to go out and support the guys and the companies that support this podcast: Deer Lab, Bighorn Outfitters, Lone Wolf, Ozonix, Gearhead, Wasp, Exodus, Ozonix, Lone Wolf, Ripcord, all those companies. Thank you to those guys, because if it wasn't for them, my wife would be really pissed at me for spending this much time in my man cave. Other than that, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, I already mentioned that. If you want to be on the podcast, hit me up either through Facebook, or you can send me an email at ninefingerchronicles@gmail.com. My kids are yelling, my dogs are barking, so that means it's time for me to go. Thank you very much for tuning in. Have an awesome holiday weekend. And remember, if you're going to be up in a tree, wear your damn safety harness. Have a good weekend. Thank you.